on This Week in Enterprise Tech. We're deep diving Microsoft Link, but first we're going to be talking about DDoS, CISPA, and Google Fiber growing. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 38, recorded April 22nd, 2013. The Missing Link. This episode of TWiT is brought to you by Rackspace, the open cloud company. At Rackspace, build what you want, where you want, and how you want it, all backed by their world-renowned fanatical support. Try it today. Download the open cloud at rackspace.com/open. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs at RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by Directory Wizards. If you have a need for a directory synchronization, Directory Wizards has the solution. Unity Sync. Offer a truly unified global address list, create a messaging forest, link seamlessly with HR databases, or build a backup forest to aid in disaster recovery. Visit dearwiz.com/enterprise for an extended evaluation that you can download, configure, and put into action today. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how it's all connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Balasair, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I'm joined by an all-star, all-character cast, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise. Brian, the evangelist for Thin Links, how are things in Honolulu?
Oh, everything's just peachy. Spent a couple weeks up in Northern California having a lot of fun. And shout out to the Hack 5 guys. It was a great party.
That's right. We got to spend some time with a new album dropping. Snubs was showing off her pipes. But you know who else has pipes? That's Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. He's the voice of Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, how are things in Florida?
It is, for us, a cool spring day, only in the low to mid-70s, kind of gray, but hey, it's Florida, we need the rain. So, a good day here in paradise.
A good day indeed. Now, we've got some super special guests from Microsoft who are going to be coming on later on the show to talk all about Link, but first, we want to go through a couple of enterprise bites. Let's start with this one. Provo, Utah, is the very next city on the Google Fiber map. That's right. They announced last week that they will be purchasing iProvo, which is Provo's existing fiber optic network. It's a different kind of rollout than what we've seen in the past, both in Kansas City and then in Austin. In this case, Google has agreed to acquire iProvo, which was a public-private collaboration, for $1. Now, for that $1, they have agreed to complete the network because it's been a couple of years in the making. They're going to have free internet to every single business and resident for a 30-day activation fee for 7 years. Now, this is an interesting rollout because this iProvo system started in the days in which you had municipalities that were getting tired of telcos just delaying and delaying and delaying the rollout of broadband internet. So they decided to build their own in three phases. The first phase was going to be three rings around the city. The second phase was going to be a test to a neighborhood to show that they actually could deliver. And the third phase was to connect everybody. Along the way, like most municipal fiber plans have been getting caught, they got caught in the details and in the fact that they didn't see a way to make the thing cost effective. Now, let me throw this out to you, Chiebert. Could this be the start of a new model for Google Fiber where they roll into failed municipal deployments of fiber and rather than laying their own and finding right of way, they just take over a project and say, let us manage it for you. We'll give you the service you built the project for, but without any of the headache.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, gee, I wish Hawaii had gotten off their behind and done something like this. This is actually a great example of public-private partnerships that can possibly work. I'm looking forward to seeing what's going on. I've spent an amazing amount of time in Provo, Utah. It's a very nice city, great restaurants, not far from the ski slopes at Park City. And darn, it couldn't have happened in a nicer place.
I really couldn't. Curtis, let me throw over to you. There is another part of this story, and that is that Provo in 2007 had to issue a new tax to raise $1.2 million to help pay off some of the debt that iProvo had incurred in the development of this new network. You also had a libertarian think tank, I believe they were called the Reason Foundation, who released a report saying that they didn't see a way for the utility to ever become self-sustaining. And yet, here is Google coming in saying, not only are we going to make this work, but we're going to give you all free access. Which makes a lot of people think, is this just going to be a loss leader for Google, or are they actually going to be able to make a network, a fiber network, make financial sense?
Well, what we have here is a lot of different economic models in play. It's important to note that Google has the luxury of building a business unit on fiber deployment. That means that they can essentially use the profits of one city to offset what might be at least a short-term loss in another. They also have the ability to bear losses for some amount of time and subsidize them through their remaining incredibly profitable businesses. With a municipality, they don't have those options. I mean, the municipalities are self-contained entities, and if there's a loss, well, that means that the taxpayers have to make it up generally that year. So Google has some economic in terms of administrative advantages. They also have the experience in running these. One of the things that we've seen in a lot of sort of public-private partnerships is that the public entities tend not to have the experience at being utilities that the enterprises do. Google can bring some of their experience running large networks to bear on this, something that Provo might not have had at its disposal. So it's not fair to say, hey, Google thinks they can make a business of this. Shouldn't Provo have been able to make it go? Two entirely different models, two entirely different sets of expertise, and two entirely different ways of looking at this as an economic ongoing concern. It seems to me that this is one of those cases where you have, in one sense, the best of both worlds, an entity that built it out and another entity that says, now that it's built out, we can make it run on an ongoing basis for, you know, a profit.
I like this. I like this. Chibert, I want to throw this back to you. Because I think Curtis is absolutely right here. You needed the municipality to build out the fiber ring, but now Google can come in. They don't have to go through the process of laying down fiber, which we've already discussed is really, really expensive. But what they can give to Provo is all that peering power. We talked about this on a previous episode of Twiat, where Google has the interconnects. They have the fiber across the country. They have the, well, let's just say the bully pulpit when it comes to running bits across the country, so that they can give Provo an exchange rate for bits that Provo couldn't get on its own. Is this the kind of partnership that we hope to see in the future? iProvo was supposed to be a public-private cooperation, but could it now be, hey, Google says to your city, you build out your fiber ring, you get us the right of way, we'll come in and actually hook you up?
I see that as a big win. The issue that I'm seeing, though, is this creating a monopoly? Are we creating a new Ma Bell? And is it now being called Google? So that's pretty much my only concern. But, you know, I think Curtis hit the nail on the head. It's transit fees, baby. And when you don't have to pay massive, massive transit fees, because the city of Provo was going to be a tier three ISP, not even a tier two, a tier three. So that means they're going to be paying out the wazoo for transit fees. Now with Google taking it over, it jumps actually, at the very least it's a tier two. It might even be considered a tier one. And gee, we were talking about Google being maybe the new tier, and that's tier zero.
I like that. Curtis, let me give you the last word here. Two things that Chibert said. The first is about that peering, about making a city, instead of a peer three, making it a peer zero, a partner with Google. And the second thing is, are you concerned at all that we're just replacing Ma Bell with Pa Google?
Well, one of the things that we've seen is that if they're done properly, monopolies are not necessarily the most evil thing in the world. They can be amazingly effective and efficient at getting something done. It's impossible that what we need to go through is a stage where we look like monopolies, at least in localities. I mean, this has worked for cable television. It's worked for other things. And it might well be the case here. In terms of this particular case, you know, I think that for the people of Provo, this sounds like a glorious opportunity. And I certainly wish that Gainesville, Florida could work out the same sort of deal with the good folks at Google, Ma, Pa, or other relation.
I think the bottom line here is that we're all impressed with the fact that it really doesn't seem that this is a flash in the pan. This may actually be a sustainable future project for Google. And isn't that just peachy? Let's move on to the second enterprise bite. This time we're talking about CISPA. Yeah, I know. We got to talk about it because it is important. A lot of people don't realize that CISPA is back, and it's back with a vengeance. Of course, we're talking about the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. Again, one of those names that we love coming up with in government. Obama has threatened to veto CISPA should it come across his desk. Now, let's actually discuss what CISPA does. Put aside all the legal speak, at the base, at its core, CISPA suspends all other privacy / data security acts on either the federal or state level and says if it's in the betterment of national security, corporations can share data with the government without a warrant and without telling anybody, and this is really important, without any sort of accountability. In other words, if Facebook, which has signed up with CISPA, suddenly shares my data, and it turns out that it wasn't for the betterment of national security, it wasn't to help the government for anything, but instead, they just turned over my data because they were lazy and they didn't want to parse through it, I have no legal recompense to go to Facebook and say, hey, you shouldn't have done that, and now here's a legal penalty that's going to hit you. Cheever, let me ask you about this. Do most people understand what CISPA is, or has it been lost? Did we have that one fight against SOPA, and now we really don't care what's going on with privacy?
I don't know. I'm kind of numb on this whole thing. There's the federal government is going to want to try and keep ramming this down our throat because they feel that the cyberspace is going to be the next battlefield. And I don't disagree. There's an awful lot of things happening that I personally think is kind of nasty. But there needs to be a balancing act. There needs to be some review of this. We need to have people other than our congressmen looking at this. We need to have industry experts. We need to have industry input because this is a sledgehammer. This is a steam shovel trying to do surgery. It needs to be leveled out, needs to be balanced. CISPA has a great potential for helping to protect the general public, but is it a fine enough tool? That's my big question.
Curtis, let me go over to you because I think Cheebert made an excellent point here, which is the thing that people are objecting to CISPA the most about is the law of unintended consequences. I think we all understand that we're in a different game. Cybersecurity is becoming more and more important, and more importantly, it's difficult in a digital world to parse out what should and should not be made public. Playing devil's advocate, the government does need some measure of cooperation from corporations if it's going to do any sort of security in a digital world. But what makes CISPA so overreaching? What makes it so distasteful to privacy experts?
Well, I think there are several aspects that make it distasteful to privacy experts. One is the no recourse side of this. I mean, if it's their ass, they have to give it over. The other is the notion that government bureaus, government agencies can ask for a lot of information without having to go through a lot of the channels that the legal system normally puts in place to make sure that they're looking at only the information that is pertinent to an investigation. I mean, this is casting a great, huge, wide net. Let me give you an example from personal life that might come into play here. When we got very excited, as we should have, about some people having photographs of young people who were that were inappropriate, we essentially deputized the people who were processing all the photos at drugstores, at big box retailers, everywhere. They saw something going through, they were supposed to notify the authorities. Well, you know what? That put their judgment into play. And that meant that there were an awful lot of people who had innocent family photos who ended up having uncomfortable conversations with law enforcement officials. Now, in this case, what we're really doing is allowing for the possibility of people to go on fishing expeditions. And that's where the problem lies. I think most companies, most service providers don't have a huge problem with someone saying, we know that this individual is storing information and we want the evidence that's in this account. What is less certain is the idea that they could come in and say, you know what? We don't know exactly where the bad guys are, but we're sure they're in there somewhere. So just give us all the data off of this block of servers and we'll figure out what's right and what's wrong. The old argument that if you're not doing anything that's wrong, you shouldn't worry, really doesn't hold as much weight when we're in a situation when, as many people have said, there is no way to guarantee that a given corporation or a given individual won't be in violation of some federal statute by doing anything that they normally do. It's a huge net and a big hammer in the hands of people who might or might not use it wisely and well.
Chibert, let me give you the last word on this one. Curtis makes a really, really good point about the level of access, about trust us, just give us this block of data and we'll come up with results. Let me play devil's advocate for the supporters of CISPA, and that is what we're talking about really is big data. We need the data sets in order to make the correlations that are going to help us to prevent future tragedies. So even though we can't really tell you exactly what we're looking for, we think it will come out in the wash. When we run these data sets through Hadoop and when we make these correlations, we think in the end that will justify the means. What's wrong with me saying just that?
Trust me, Dave. Dave, I can't open that for you. No, there is a distinct possibility that because humans are involved, someone's going to get carried away. What needs to be put into place if we do something like this is a strong set of rules saying thou shalt not do this or thou shalt not do that. It's kind of like, you know, if you want to draw an analogy, it's kind of like, gee, all we have to do is put a warrant in and we can seize everything in the apartment building. That's what CISPA is kind of alluding to because it's too big a tool. There needs to be a lot more fine tools. It needs to be a Swiss Army knife. You need some small blades and you need some medium blades, but you can't go and say, I want everything. That's what gets me worried. And when humans are involved, humans make mistakes. Humans have egos. You know, I guess we can kind of put it in the same category as like, religion. You know, maybe we need a set of rules, mandates, commandments to help guide the people lest they make mistakes.
That's what we're here about on TWiET. We want the 10 commandments of security. Now, I want to take a break to thank one of the sponsors of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I'm glad that they're on the show because you know what? They really, really get us. The talk these days is all about the open web. It's all about OpenStack. It's all about getting your services, about your products, about your business, your network, up into the cloud. That's why I'm really, really happy that Rackspace has joined us as part of the TWiET Riot. You see, not everyone talking about cloud computing is the same. Some use proprietary technology, which makes it expensive, almost impossible to move your data if you want to leave. So what you want is an open cloud solution built on standards. That's why we've got Rackspace. Rackspace was one of the co-founders of OpenStack and the Open Cloud. Open Cloud means that you're not locked into a single provider. If you want to take your data, your services, and leave, you can do it. In fact, you can go to Rackspace right now, rackspace.com open, download the Open Cloud, install it on your own servers, and have your cloud duplicated on your own gear. It's really that simple. You have the freedom to move your apps, your code base, your websites between multiple OpenStack-based clouds, public or private, on-premise, or hosted. Big business or small, public or private, services or data, Rackspace is perfect for the TWiET crowd because they get the enterprise. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to build what you want, where you want, and how you want, all backed by Rackspace world-renowned fanatical support. Try it today. Download the Open Cloud at rackspace.com/open. That's rackspace.com/open. And we thank Rackspace for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Chebert and Curtis, we've got a little treat here. It's time for another Stuff My IT Guy Says. That sounds cool.
I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, host of TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the TWiT Network. I'm here at the super secret location of the Hot Stage Warehouse for Interop, and I'm sitting next to Sam Richmond for another episode of Stuff My IT Guy Says. Sam, thank you very much for coming on to talk to us.
Here.
You're here to drop the knowledge about DOS. No, I'm not talking about the disk operating system. It's about the denial of service attack, which if you've ever been on the internet, if you've ever listened to the news, you've probably heard of. In layman's terms, what is a denial of service attack?
Well, a denial of service attack is when an attacker is sending traffic to your service, web service, that it's unable to handle, thus preventing legitimate traffic from coming into it.
Right. And one of the important parts about this is it's traffic that it's indistinguishable from legitimate traffic. So, for example, your web server is there to respond to requests for the pages that it holds. So, on an average basis, let's say your server gets 10 requests a second. A denial of service attack might bump that up to 10,000 requests a second, which means that it needs to serve them all out unless it wants to miss out on legitimate traffic or it just overloads.
Indeed.
Indeed. DOS attacks were really popular at the start of interconnected networks. It was a really good way to knock somebody off the network. But they kind of fell out of favor. Why is that?
Well, it's pretty easy to mitigate a DOS attack at this point because if they're simply coming from a single IP, one can simply block them a number of ways, on their router, a firewall, even on their host system, as a matter of fact. So it's pretty easy to mitigate at this point.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I remember in the early days of Interop when we started getting DOSed, it was easy enough to contact whoever was providing our bandwidth and say, you know what, don't even let the attack get as far as our firewall. We don't want to drop it at the firewall because that still wastes our bandwidth.
True.
Drop it up top where they have 100 gigabits of bandwidth, and it's not going to matter. Yeah. All right. So we move from DOS to DDoS, distributed denial of service attack. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that works.
Well, by the name distributed, that implies this is not a single attacker, this is multiple attackers, thousands of attackers, millions of attackers. The trouble with this particular attack is not only is it that impossible to keep track of who's sending that traffic, but also those IPs may not even be valid. So you may not even be able to block them because if when they're detected as being blocked, the attacker will simply change their IPs. So you could have hundreds of thousands or millions of zombie PCs hitting you from around the world.
Right.
And they're very hard to track.
That's one of the more complicated parts, which is not only are you going to hit dead ends because the attackers have spoofed their IPs, but most of the IPs, that's like 99.9% of the IPs of a distributed denial of service attack will be from machines that have been compromised. They've got malware on them, and all they're doing is they're probably logged into an IRC channel somewhere, waiting for an address to pop up, and then they all attack at the same time. That's the stuff we hear on the news. But what's actually happening on the hardware level? Let's go to the server that's being attacked, or the cluster of servers being attacked. What does it look like from the inside?
So from the inside, the first thing that's going to get hit is your actual web server processes that are running on that server. You're going to have a limited number of processes running. You're going to have scoped this out to be what you expect your traffic load to be. So you're going to start seeing your web server actually starting to slow down, not being able to respond to the number of requests it's receiving. The number of requests that it is receiving, if the DDoS is sending a lot of data through, you're going to start taxing your I.O. You're going to start taxing your data, your disks. So it pretty much wreaks havoc on the system overall, not to mention even at the network layer, you're starting to run out of ports, socket. I mean, you're really hitting it pretty hard. So a couple other things.
Before we started filming, you were mentioning the cumulative effect of a denial of service attack, and that is once you have a server that is receiving more requests than it can handle per second, they start to queue up. Sure. And once they start to queue up, we run into, and anyone who watched our Routing 101 segment will know this, we run into the TTL, the time to live, in which requests, the packets, will actually start to expire and get resent, which then just is another round of denial of service attacks.
Even worse.
Okay. So that's what's happening on the hardware level. Now we understand why the servers are slowing down. What are the ways that we can mitigate a denial of service attack?
Because of the challenges that are being presented by the distributed aspect of this attack, one needs to get a little bit outside of the conventional ways of resolving this problem. So what you really need to do is implement a solution that's going to inspect the actual application traffic that's coming into your server and to see if it can determine whether it's truly legitimate or not. And not only that, but there are also ways on these solutions to actually challenge or analyze the sender itself to attempt to drop the attack down to normal levels of traffic. So, again, a less conventional solution on the front end to resolve this problem.
Well, I would gather it's a little bit like a cat and mouse game, because if you spell out your solution, eventually they're going to figure out a way to write around it.
True.
Okay.
That is true.
Now, in a future episode, we are going to show you some of those unconventional methods. But till then, I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, and this has been an episode of Stuff My IT Guy Says.
Ah, my old friend, the DDoS. Cheebert, I remember back in the day where you could knock a user off a 10 megabit network simply by pinging his station a whole heck of a lot. How things have advanced. Now, at a university, you probably get a lot of attack traffic coming over zombified machines, yes?
Oh, yeah. As a university, we are a big, fat, stationary target, which drives everybody crazy. Typically, universities have very large pipes. Typically, universities have kind of a laissez-faire attitude about machines. So every time I go and probe the network, it's always, well, not shocking, but disturbing how many people aren't keeping up with patches. So what we start getting is, when you start looking around, how many zombies do we have? How do you block them? You start having to get more and more invested into intrusion prevention systems and stuff like that just to keep up with all the crud. One of the weird stories is that anytime Interop in the old days used to advertise the 45/8 network, instantly 7 meg of crud would come down just from zombies. So that's quite a bit of bandwidth sucked up just by advertising your domain.
Right. Curtis, let me ask you, as the representative of the enterprise community of executives, is there awareness that even though DDoS is a really unsophisticated attack, that it has the most potential for actual financial damage for most companies? Do they understand that the DDoS is the brute force equivalent of just whacking your server upside the head?
I think most executives have a basic understanding of what DDoS is and does. I think where their understanding tends to trail off is when it gets to what the upstream implications are. And as an example, my publication, Enterprise Efficiency, is part of a publishing group. We were hit with a DDoS attack a couple of months ago. And the DDoS attack actually went against an unused block of addresses that we had. But because it was so large, so effective, our upstream providers shut down access to our entire block of addresses, knocked not just our publication, but every publication owned by our publisher off the internet for more than 24 hours while we looked for a resolution. That's the point at which a lot of people don't understand. A lot of executives think, hey, if our firewalls, if our routers are able to deal with this, then our problems are solved. Not at all the case. The volume of traffic can cause an upstream ISP to block access to not just the affected addresses, but the entire block owned by the organization. And that can have some repercussions that last far longer than executives really want to think about.
Right, right. Now, next week, we're going to be giving you another segment that's going to be, well, discussing some of the strategies for mitigating a DDoS attack. And actually, in 2 weeks, Chi, Bert, Curtis, and I will be at Interop broadcasting live from the Network Operations Center. And we're actually going to run a DDoS against our own network during the broadcast to show you that, yes, you can protect yourself. Now, before we get to our super, super secret Microsoft Link segment, I do want to take a moment to talk about another one of our sponsors. That's RingCentral. When we built the studio, Leo decided that we were going to go whole hog in the cloud. We do everything in the cloud, everything from our email to our show prep to our document storage. We do everything because we want to do everything in the cloud. So when Russell, our IT guy, told us that we could also have our phone system in the cloud, it was a no-brainer. We don't have to have a bulky PBX system in the basement. We don't have to have a dedicated person to service our phones. We don't need a PhD in telephony in order to change our email and our voicemail settings. It's all handled by RingCentral. There are zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain, and RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. Our producers get their voicemail in their emails, and we can even get all of our fax messages right on our smartphones. And now they have a brand spanking new feature, RingCentral Conferencing. You can get your own single conference bridge number ready for an unlimited conference call for up to 1,000 participants. That's right, you can mute participants, get caller count, record conferences, and more, all from a central interface. It's easy to use, works with your desk phone, iPhone or Android, and RingCentral soft phone. It's free with your monthly service. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to try RingCentral's all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Hey, no, seriously, write this down, 800-543-9980. Or you can also go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get to the meat of the show. We're talking all about Microsoft Link, and we've got two super special guests, one who's coming back, Mr. Lou Maresca. He's, I think, our favorite member of the Microsoft Twiet Riot. Lou, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're coming from, and what you're doing here on Twiet.
Sure. Thanks for having me back. So I'm a Microsoft developer. I've been at Microsoft for roughly around 9 years now and been working on multiple products from the Dynamics division, which is like business software, ERP or enterprise resource planning software, to CRM applications. Now I'm on the CRM team and I work on the Outlook client team, which is the integration of CRM within Outlook. And that's basically what I'm working on now. And we're trying to improve the product, we're adding some new features. Stuff like that. So I've been with Microsoft and both in Fargo, North Dakota, and in Redmond, Washington. So I've been kind of across the country with them.
And of course, Lou is Lou MM in the chat room. He's a longtime member of the Twit community. And Lou brought with him a super, super special guest. That's Marcelo Fargiala, who is a Microsoft Senior Program Manager. Marcelo, thank you very much for coming on. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your responsibilities at Microsoft?
Hi, Padre. Thanks for having me. I've been with Microsoft for 7 years, and the entirety of the 7 years have been on the Link team. Used to be called Communicator. I'm a senior program manager. I've worked on Communicator Web Access for two releases. I worked on the Link client SDK for two releases, and now I am taking over voice video for the Link desktop.
We've had quite a few discussions on Link here on Twiet. In fact, we had one, I think it was just 2 weeks ago, when we were discussing how it could be embedded into whatever my company needs for an interface. So the best example we could come up with was, whereas someone might use Skype as a communication tool in order to have a video conference with someone that they were also doing business with, Link could actually be embedded into the application that I use to do business. That's really good at the 10,000-foot level, but Marcella, maybe you can explain a bit more. How does that work? How do I take Link and actually embed it into what I'm working on?
So the Link-rich client, the desktop client, as opposed to the modern apps and the mobile apps, it has a very rich, robust SDK. It allows you it ships with UI controls. So we have a flavor of WPF controls and Silverlight controls that you can embed inside of your own application. There's access to the underlying object model for Link, and you can call this via .NET APIs or from Silverlight. So you could provide those entry points in your application, and you would launch Link. And not only that, you could send application-specific data along with the invite. And with that, you can customize the Link conversation window. So you can have your own UI within Link conversation window that would take that data that came from your originating application and just customize for, say, a call center type application, for example. Mm-hmm. This is all from the Link SDK. You can download the SDK for free. Just search for Link 2013 or 2010 SDK. It's very easy to use. You can probably within a week have Link integrated throughout all your LOB applications in your enterprise.
If Jemmer B will show my desktop real quick, I've actually got the new Windows app version of Link running on my laptop right now. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about this is I can actually switch back and forth between texting, between standard video conferencing, and right now Lou is sharing his desktop with me. It's a slick interface, but I'm going to get this question from people in the chat room, and that is, why Link? Why wouldn't I go with just the solution I've got right now? Why wouldn't I go with Skype? Why wouldn't I go with whatever other collaboration suite I've been using? What is it about Link that you think is most compelling, most makes people want to switch over?
So I see Link very differently from other collaboration tools. For example, you use Skype as an example. Link is an enterprise-grade real-time collaboration tool. It takes your business into account. It has beefed up security. It has enterprise compliance. It has four nines of reliability. It has telephony features that compete with PBX systems. So the proposition here is you can rip out your PBXs in your enterprise and have all your real-time communications, including your desktop phones, all running through software, through Link. So to me, this is a huge proposition. Here at Microsoft, we haven't had desk phones for 5-6 years. It was painful in the beginning as our team was developing through the releases. But in 2010, I saw that as our coming out party. We don't miss our desk phones at all. And I don't see any other competitor or any other alternative communication client really providing that kind of enterprise-grade real-time communication.
Right. Okay, so I'm going to ask some questions here. I don't want to seem as if I'm playing a gotcha game here, mm-hmm. but if I don't ask, the chat room is going to think that I'm going soft on Microsoft, and that is yep. I've got at least 3 or 4 people, everyone from Red 5 to CSI Raid, who are asking why is it that Link doesn't backward support a lot of the technologies that had been used before, Communicator or some of the OC products?
I'd be surprised. I'm surprised to hear that. As enterprise grade, we do provide backward compatibility N-2. So Link does support, this Link server, for example, 15, which is 2013, does support Link 2010 clients signing into it. We also do a lot of work to support interop with Outlook back to 2010. So our normal policy is N-2. So we would support two clients back, from the current release. So.
Right. We've also got people in the chat room. Maybe we can toss over to Lou for this, who are asking, well, does it work on Mac? Does it work on mobile devices? We did a conference call yesterday, Lou. We had a Surface, we had a Windows phone, we had a Win 8 device, we had a Win 7 device, and we had an iPad. Lou, do you find Link to be more compatible across platforms than, say, other communication suites that you've used?
Yeah, I mean, it's got quite a bit of capabilities. I mean, like you said, we had an iPad. It even has a web integrated app that supports video. So, I mean, there's not a lot of there's not a lot of communication apps applications or even at the enterprise level that have just a web app version of it. They also have a phone edition. They have Mac edition. They also have a Windows Store app, and they have two different types of clients. They have the enterprise client and a basic client. Basic being free, anybody can download it if they want to participate in a meeting that's happening at a company that actually has a Link account or a Link SCAL. So there's just a lot of capabilities that other ones don't have.
Lou, right now you are running a shared desktop on my laptop, which we can see. Mm-hmm. You were going to take us through some of the applications that have integrated Link into their solution. Could you run us through and just show us some of the ones that you like?
Yeah, so there's some crazy cool ones out here that I have that integrate Link. Like, for instance, this one by Proton Media. It's got Link integrated conversations in kind of like a 3D, what they call Photosphere 2.0, where you can have like meetings in a 3D space. And so each person has an avatar and they can walk around and talk to each other and chat with each other. Kind of something out of the future sort of thing. And this is kind of built on top of the Link integrated platform that they have. That's very neat. Some other interesting ones are, for instance, like call accounting and call management from a customer service side of things. This is by Mind. And so they do have some interesting ones. There's a whole list of them out there that you can go through. Like, for instance, a lot of them that integrate with telephony options. This one's integrating with an iPhone. That's kind of interesting. This is also integrating with an iPhone. There's also some other ones in here that just integrate things like conversation analyzers that will go and analyze and find terms in dictionaries. This one's a conversation translator. We can actually translate on the fly as people type in different languages. And there's just like endless possibilities when it comes to these APIs that they support. I mean, they support the persistent chat API, which is like what they used to call group API or group chat. They also support Link Manage API, which is, content sharing and application sharing. And then they also support, SharePoint, IAM Presence, all of that stuff in the Unified Communications Web API. So there's quite a bit of capabilities that this can do from a scalability and a customization standpoint.
Chibert, let me throw over to you. You were on the Link bandwagon a while back. You actually got one of the very first versions. And you told me at the time, this might have been almost a decade ago, that this was going to take over. Why are you so big on Link? What are the features that draw you the most?
Well, Link is one of those technologies that, chat's wonderful, voice is wonderful, being able to share your desktop is wonderful. But oh my, when you have all of them together, that's what really makes it cool. Jammerbee, I've got a Link highlighted in the thing. Oh, sorry, wrong one. I'm going to put it in different colors so you can see it. I actually wrote an article in InfoWorld magazine quite a while ago. And I started talking about the big thing is Link is threaded through the entire office environment. So, for instance, the example I highlighted was Francois Dorimou of the Microsoft Link group came and we set up basically a turnkey Link system right in my lab. Now, without modifying any firewall rules, without adding any kinds of quality of service or anything, we actually were able to look through a federated Link, so it's a limited trust connection to some different corporations that he does work with. We found out that one of his friends at the Georgia Military Academy was available, even though it was fairly late in Georgia, and started a chat with him. Now, he knew about this because the orb next to his name was green. And if you're busy, it'll go orange. If you're in do not disturb, it'll go red. So at a glance, you're able to see whether the person is busy or not. So that saves you the, you know, instead of doing the voicemail chase, now all of a sudden I don't even need to make that call because I know the person's busy or unavailable. Well, the person was available. We started chat, asked if he was willing to do a video conference. We actually brought up a 720p video conference on the fly. And the clarity of the image was so good, even without Quas, that I could actually see little curlicues of smoke coming up off his cigarette. Now, one of the other things I did, at the very bottom, there is a VoiceCon competition that was done in Orlando 2010, where they started looking at, you know, how much do PBXs really cost? Now, this was a PBX-centric competition. And Link actually won as being the most cost-effective PBX of that competition. That kind of speaks volumes on just how well Link can do as a PBX replacement.
Curtis, let me throw over to you, again, as our enterprise representative. We've seen a lot of Link. We were both at Enterprise Connect this year in Orlando, Florida, and there are so many companies that have integrated Link into their solution, be it hardware or their software solutions. Giancarlo in the chat room was reminding us that enterprise won't do it unless it's simple. They don't want a lot of different modules. They don't want a really complicated setup. What is it about Link that has so many companies in the enterprise offering enterprise-class solutions excited about integrating it into whatever product they may offer?
Well, I think one of the big things is the fact that Link already integrates a number of significant features. And much of that has to do with the way that Link integrates with other products in the Microsoft suite of back-end products. It integrates nicely with Active Directory. It integrates very nicely with SharePoint. It's very easy to share documents created with the Microsoft Personal Productivity Tools, the Microsoft Office suite. So there's already a lot of integration built in that you can then go ahead and build upon. And third-party developers like that a lot. Furthermore, the enterprise likes it a lot because even though this is a fairly complex product, it does a lot. It has a lot of moving pieces and parts. The integration pieces are pretty simple. When you get right down to it, in a very short period of time, you can have a demonstration product or a sandbox up and running so that you can then go ahead and have your IT team work on the details that will make it ideal for your organization. Put it all together, and it means that as a platform, it has the critical mass that so many people are looking for. And right now, no other products really have that same level of critical mass. And makes for a pretty compelling argument when it comes to doing unified communications in the enterprise. Right.
Marcelo, I want to throw back over to you. Red5 in the chat room has mentioned a Network World report that said Link was one of the most expensive PBX-type systems to set up. That report is a little bit suspect, but there is, I'd say, an underlying feeling that, well, it's too complicated, it's too expensive, it's going to take too much of my time, too many of my resources. Can you spell out for me exactly what would I need to do? Let's say I'm running a 5,000-seat enterprise. What do I need to get Link up and running in my enterprise?
So we do provide a number of topology planning tools that you can get from the web. Also, we have partners that can assist with the deployment. For 5,000 users, you probably need a few front-end servers, depending on what kind of functionality you wanted. If just IAM and presence, that would be sufficient. If you needed a connection to the PSTN, you'd also set up a mediation server. Again, this is all for on-premise. Now, with 2013, we have an O365 deployment that is a lot more cost-effective and easier to set up. You just need an account, really. You're set up with a tenant in the cloud, and you know, for people who in the past have thought Link was too complicated, I definitely invite them to check out our O365 Link solutions.
Okay. Chibert, I want to go back over to you. One of the things that I noticed in the Link test that we did was that the video and the audio was actually quite good, better than, say, Skype. What is it about you had an article once about the codecs that Microsoft secured in order to provide greater, let's just say, constancy along the quality for actual telecommunications?
Yeah, Microsoft put a lot of money and effort into building some fairly new codecs. They're based upon prior work, so it's not like it's a 0-year model. But their codecs do a lot of forward error correction, and they don't, what, you know, from the user standpoint, what's really different about them is they don't break up, so to speak. You know, there might be an error, but you get maybe a block that's out of place. A lot of other video codecs, if they lose something like a keyframe, the entire image dissolves into a mosaic and then has to be rebuilt. The Link codecs don't do that. Now, one thing that a lot of people keep forgetting is that Link is more than just audio and video. It is scalability. It is a unified communication system. That makes it very powerful. The codecs themselves are truly amazing. And I would love to be able to share with you the names, but for the life of me, I just can't remember.
Okay. Lou, let me throw over to you. I've got a few guys in the chat room. Actually, the chat room is getting very, let's just say their swords are out. They're sharpened. They're all screaming that they've got the solution that they like. They like ShoreTel. They like Cisco. They want someone who has more cloud service integration, someone who can actually handle the PTS, the POTS lines handoff. Does Microsoft have any strategy for taking something like Office 365 and Link built into Office 365 and providing a complete cloud-based solution so that I could have an enterprise-class PBX through links without actually having to deploy anything on-premise?
So, you know, I'm going to be honest, I'm not really familiar with what they're going to continue to do. I know right now they have support for some through third-party. And so that, I think right away, as you set up an Office 365 account, they support, you know, the main of telephony type of events. But then being able to do that type of thing has to go through a third party. Maybe Marcelo might have some more information, but I'm not familiar where they're kind of going with that.
Okay. Yeah, Marcelo, what can you tell us? I don't want to get you in trouble, so just smile if you can't say. But
So just to add, you know, we're all in, you know, to sound cliche, with the cloud. You know, moving forward, the cloud is our investment. And you know, whereas before on-premise was our primary solution, it really is the cloud is a first-class citizen now with Link. And if today we don't have the parity that we have with on-premise solutions, that parity is going to quickly close the gap. So I have no, you know, I can share that, and I'm certain that we will get there in the cloud.
Okay. Yeah. Let me ask you this, because this is another one of these questions that I'm sure people are wanting to ask, and that is Skype, Link, where do they fit in? How do they live together under the same company?
So I'm super excited to have Skype within Microsoft. For Link, you know, as an enterprise solution, we've always been very confident in our functionality. When it came to getting the Link network that our customers built up within their enterprises, it was difficult to open up that network to their consumers. So with Skype, I see it a perfect marriage between our enterprise expertise in Link and the consumer network that Skype provides right from the acquisition. So, you know, Link and Skype is doing, we're doing interop work. We've released our first phase of that interop work, which is voice, IM, and presence. We're continuing to do a video now, and you'll continue to see the two interacting very well together, and just the enterprises, you know, getting with their investment this open, you know, huge network of Skype users at their disposal. So I see a huge value gain for Link and our customers.
Okay, I like that. So do you, I mean, let's break it down even further. Do you see in the long-term strategy that Skype becomes the consumer tool? As Giancarlo in the chat room mentioned, is it going to be the entryway into Link on the enterprise if you have Skype for the consumer?
I can't speak for what our roadmap is too much, but I see Skype today being our entry point to the consumer for the enterprise, yes. That's very clear to me, and the value should be clear to everybody.
Okay. Lou, let me go over to you. There's some angst in the chat room. There's people who are complaining, well, the Android app for Link isn't so great, or I don't like it that it does this on my iPad or this on my iPhone. Or some people are complaining about the Metro interface. I'm sorry, the Windows Store interface or the desktop interface for Windows 8. There right. seems to be a lot of... Well, anger that it's not perfect yet, that I'm not getting the same experience across different platforms, that I'm not getting a unified experience across platforms. Do you think that that's something that we're going to see as Link continues to move on, that we will see a unification? Or more likely, is this something that as people roll out Link into their own solutions, they're going to be the ones who determine how the experience looks on their solution?
Yeah, so I think it's kind of a little bit of both. I mean, we're always trying to kind of unify the experience that an application has at Microsoft. A lot of us, you know, the way CRM works in like a Safari browser versus, you know, in like IE on Windows, we're trying to kind of unify that experience. And Link's kind of trying to do the same thing. But also, a lot of these devices have very specific UX paradigms or capabilities or even ways of doing things that people follow, these standards. And they want to keep those experiences the same, whether you're on, like, for instance, on an iPad using, some of their apps versus, you know, some of their apps and some of their controls versus using the Link application, Android, that kind of thing. And same thing with Windows Phone or even Windows 8 store apps, is that you kind of have these different standards that are standards for those types of applications that they want to kind of take advantage of those and use those capabilities, especially like for instance, touch experience in the Windows Store apps. And so there is going to be, I'm going to say that possibly we're kind of unified that type of thing, but, you know, they're going to try to keep them separate in a way where they're kind of following those standards as well. And again, third party is, you know, the sky's the limit there. So whatever they want to do there from building an application on these platforms, they can just go wherever they want with that.
Marcelo, I know that you've got time constraints, so I'm going to let you go. But before you do, we have one straight up question from the chat room, and Dr. T, who asks, will Skype calls be answerable on Link and vice versa?
So the Skype interop work that we're doing is exactly to be able to find a Skype user within Link and make those calls happen, and vice versa in Skype being able to call a Link user. So yes, that's clear right now. I believe we have released the first phase of that interop, which is voice, IM, and presence. And we have video coming. We have presented that at our first Link conference 2013. So that's public information.
So there you go.
Patrick,
direct answer.
Thanks for having me here.
Yes. Let me give you your 60 seconds. What do you want the Twilight Riot to know about you, about Microsoft, about your product group? Anything you want to talk about, go.
I just want to say Link's a great product. I've been with it for 5 releases now. I tell everyone it's the only place in Microsoft I want to work. It's such a relevant product to how we do business, how we communicate within the enterprise, and now within the enterprise out to consumers with Skype. So for those of you who haven't tried Link and you have telephony needs in your enterprise, which is everybody, Link should definitely be something that you investigate. If you have in the past, try so again. We have the cloud offerings that make things a lot easier and more cost effective for smaller businesses. That's it. Thanks for having me, Padre.
Thank you for coming on. That's Marcelo Farhala, the Microsoft Senior Program Manager at Link. Thank you very much for coming on. Now, Lou, we're not done with you yet. So let's hammer on you a bit more about this. I do want to come back to the integration of Link into various applications. Again, we've touched on it a little bit before. I want to get really, really concrete. We've already had Marcelo answer one direct question. Yes, there will be interoperability between Link and Skype. I want to get direct with you about the integration of Link into various applications and solutions. How do you see Link being used in the enterprise? Not as a standalone solution, not as just something that people will bring up, but as something that's actually integrated into, let's say, the sales screen that employee X may have at a company, or at the database screen that another employee may have at his company. What is the plus side to that level of integration?
Oh, man, I could probably go for hours about that, but to kind of bring it down to the basic level is, you know, for instance, even with CRM, we've had it integrated with Link capabilities, presence, and phone call. So, for instance, you know, with CRM type systems, you know, you have somebody, you know, you're calling customers, you're talking with, you know, sales opportunities, leads, that kind of thing, and you want to be able to just not have to think about, it's kind of like a secondary thing, not have to really think about this unified communication side of things of how to call them, you know, where to find their information, see if they're available, you know, organize meetings, share things on SharePoint, that kind of thing. And so that's where kind of Link comes in, is integrating that capability directly in the app where you don't really have to think about it anymore. And that happens with both CRM, it happens in, you know, medical, it happens in bank systems, if they want to, internal type communications. It happens in retail. I've seen stores actually walk around with tablets, and they have integrated within their, for instance, their retail or their inventory systems, where they want to say, hey, I want to talk to the inventory manager, tap on the presence and call that inventory manager. And he can even share his inventory information with that person right on the tablet. So there's like almost endless capabilities that having Link integrated to your app, if you just think about it from a unified communications and sharing capabilities standpoint.
We're going to have one last round of the deep dive on Link right as soon as we get back from talking about one last sponsor. You know, we get a lot of questions. We get a lot of questions in email, on Twitter, and in the Google Plus page for Twyatt. And it's interesting that a lot of the questions we get, a lot of the troubleshooting requests that we get, have to deal with one of the more simple items in the IT world. And that is, how do you get data from one email server to another, from one AD server to another? In other words, how do you synchronize what you've got? Well, that's why I'm happy to announce that Directory Wizards has come to the rescue of the Twyatt audience with their all-in-one synchronization solution, Unity Sync. Unity Sync by Directory Wizards provides synchronization solutions, offering countless customizable options to conquer the challenges of your environment. They offer a truly unified GAL, that's a global address list, that lets you create a messaging force, link seamlessly with HR databases, or build a backup force to aid in disaster recovery. Unity Sync also supports multiple directory types, including Active Directory, Open LDAP, Oracle, Novell, Lotus Notes, Domino, GroupWise, multiple SQL and ODBC databases, and text formats. They scale from small directories with hundreds of objects to enterprise directories consisting of hundreds of thousands of objects without requiring extensive training or installation time. In fact, your fully functional evaluation copy can be up and running today. They download it at only 5 megabytes. That's really how simple the solution is. There are no per-user costs or limits. Pricing is per installation, per number of directories being synchronized, and upgrades and live technical support for one full year is included in your purchase and renewable with our yearly maintenance contract. The web-based user interface is intuitive and friendly. There's no scripting or programming required. And one great feature is that no additional database is required. Unity Sync is entirely self-contained, synchronizing data from one directory to another without the need to create a third. You can do full or partial directory synchronization, affecting all available or just a few attributes. Whatever your needs, Unity Sync can be configured to suit them. Now, you want to go with Unity Sync because they're the company that the United States military goes with, that the NFL goes with. In fact, they're the company that the companies who need to have pure synchronization, 100% accurate synchronization, go to when they can't have a fail. That's why I want you to try Directory Wizards and their product, Unity Sync. Visit Directory Wizards now at DIRWIZ.com/enterprise for an extended evaluation that you can download, configure, and put into action today. That's dirwiz.com/enterprise. And we thank Directory Wizards for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, one last round of the table. Shevert, let's go with you. What do you want people to know about Link? Pro or con, what are the things that they need to keep in mind if they're looking at a deployment?
Link gives you the ability to implement business rules in your communications. So, like, for instance, I got dropped into this meeting late, and I tried to text Lumaresca. Well, it comes back and says, this message wasn't sent because Louis Maresca doesn't want to be disturbed. So the cool thing is, if Lou added me, say, to his working group, you can actually set up a rule that I can text him, and then, but I can't do a video conference or a voice call to him. So that gives me the ability to go into a meeting and say get last minute numbers into something. And so Lou just sent me a new invitation. Thanks, Lou. And I am now back into the system.
Persistent.
So anyway, it's all about business rules. That's one thing that makes Link very, very different from a lot of the other solutions out there.
Same question over to you, Curtis. What is it that you think people should know, positive or negative, about Link if they're looking at starting a deployment?
Well, I think the positive side is that the integration is relatively straightforward if you're already a pretty thoroughly baked Microsoft shop. The bad news is that, like SharePoint, just because it integrates relatively straightforward doesn't mean it's inexpensive to either fully integrate or to continue the care and feeding. And this is a big package. It has a lot of moving pieces and parts, and it's going to take some expertise to make sure that it's running in as efficient and effective a way as possible. So it's not a small commitment, but it's the sort of thing that if you've decided that unified communications are part of your overall strategy for keeping your employees tied together, it's worth making a look and seeing if it's worth the investment if you're already deep into Microsoft territory.
Lou, I'm going to give you the very, very last word. If someone comes up to you and says, look, I need to know, honestly, what are the pros and cons of installing Link in my enterprise? I need to know how much it's going to cost. I need to know what challenges I'm going to face in the first year. How do you honestly tell them about Link?
Well, just exactly like Curtis said, I mean, it depends how deep you want to go in the integration. If you're already a Microsoft shop, it's a little easier for you. But for instance, you know, right up front, I think Marcelo kind of mentioned this, is, you know, kind of the Office 365 integration. I mean, that cost alone, I think it was, I can't remember exactly, but I think it was like $5 extra per user per month to kind of add the Link capabilities into your Office 365. So you kind of get all of the capabilities, you know, from the AV and multi-person voice chatting, IM presence, all that stuff kind of built in right away, already set up for you off-premise, kind of in the cloud. That's already set up. It's very easy. Just click a button, it sets up the server for you, and then you immediately start install the client and you start using it from that perspective. But then if you want to kind of have an on-premise where you want to kind of control some more things, like the front end type thing, things, you want to control the back end, you want to control bandwidth, latency, you want to control like the SIP integration with the kind of the public switch telephone network with the PSTNs. If you want to control, you know, the type of capabilities that it's doing from video feeds to participants, all that, then you have to kind of go deep into figuring out what you need and how scalable you need it to be, like how many servers it needs per user. And I think Marcelo kind of got into that where he said, you know, maybe you might need only two front-end servers and one back-end server, depending on the load. So there's a little bit more to kind of go into that, and that's kind of where TechNet and MSDN come in. They kind of point you in the right direction. They give you some tools to say, hey, if I'm going to have 5 to 100 users or 1 to 100 users, here's how, like, how many front-ends you probably need, and here's kind of what the type of machine you're going to need. And if you want to kind of have the integration of the two, if you want to have to do the PSTN side or the SIP side, on-prem versus the cloud orientation, you kind of have to have, you know, figure out the integration with that. So there are some, you know, depending on if it's on-prem or in the cloud. The in-cloud obviously is one top solution, easy to get there. If somebody said you want to get integrated with Link right away, that would be my first recommendation, is to kind of go there. So it's just very powerful, very easy. You saw it only took me, 10, 20 minutes yesterday setting everyone up on Link. So that's kind of the key.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, you've done it again. You have used up another hour listening to the best, absolutely number one rated enterprise tech show on the TWiT network on Mondays at noon. And I thank you for that. Now, before we go, I do want to give my panelists a round to talk about whatever projects they may be working on. Let's start with you, Chibert. What's going on? What does the TWiT Riot need to know about the Geek in Paradise?
The TWiT Riot? Guys, Hack 5.
Oh, yes. Show Hack 5 some love. So, Chibert, what are you going to be doing with that pineapple?
Well, it can be used for a lot of bad things, but I'm going to see what I can use it for on, say, auditing Wi-Fi networks and things like that. I'm going to see if I can do more white hat types of things instead of black hat.
Oh, and I like it. This week in the pineapple. What about you, Curtis? Are you going to be doing some white hat, black hat, gray hat stuff? What's going on at Enterprise Efficiency?
Well, one of the things that we're really turning up the heat on is our conversations with innovative CIOs. And here's something I would love to hear from the TWiT crew. If there are CIOs you would like to hear from, if there are stories you would like to hear, or if there are questions you would like us to ask the CIOs of, say, the Fortune 500, let me know what they are. Drop me a note at the Twitter?
The Twitter. The tweets. Yeah, tweets thing.
The Tweety thing, or email franklin@enterpriseefficiency.com.
And Lou, on to you. Thank you very much again for coming on. It's always a wonderful time to have you. And you brought a friend this time, so double thanks to you. What's going on in Lou world?
Yeah, it's always fun. Basically, we're still working on the CRM product, but one of the biggest things is that we're really excited about, actually, is the kind of the cross-platform release of CRM that's coming out, and the capability of being able to use it on all these different platforms, kind of getting, like you were talking about before, getting a very similar experience amongst all these platforms, whether it be Windows Phone or Windows 8 store app type of thing, as well as the iPad, Macs, Windows. And so that's kind of makes this sets us apart, because we have these rich integrated platforms that you're going to have built on all these different operating systems to help you as a consumer to kind of pick and choose of what you want to use, what you want to integrate. And even with the Link capabilities now of being able to kind of use it on multiple platforms and build your own solutions on top of them, it makes it even more so of a value proposition. So continue to work on that stuff, and hopefully you guys see some stuff coming out soon.
Thank you. Thank you very much to all of my panelists. Now, I want to talk to you. That's right, to you, to the people who are listening, who are watching This Week in Enterprise Tech. Did you know that you could have TWiT delivered to your device of choice each and every single week automatically without you having to do a single thing? That's right. If you go to our show page right now at twit.tv/TWiT, you can find all the different ways that you can subscribe to This Week in Enterprise Tech. You want it downloaded onto your iPhone? Of course, your iPad, duh. Want to drop it onto your Android tablet or phone? That we got links for that. Even if you want to get it on your Zombie Zune, we've got it for you, because that's the kind of love we've got for the TWiT Riot. But you know, it's not all downloads and sunshine. You can also watch us make the sausage live each and every single week, noon, Mondays, here at live.twit.tv. Also, as long as you're watching the live show, you can jump into the chat room. And I kid you not when I say that the chat room really is the number one feature of the TWiT TV network. It is an experiment, not just in communications, but in the wonderful temporary community that is the TWiT Army. So jump on in, talk to me during the show, and ask me a couple of questions. Maybe I'll answer your question on the air. Also, please stop by the TWiT YouTube page at youtube.com/TWiT. You'll be able to subscribe and get all of our latest episodes. And we're going to be posting some bonus features. That's right. The segments of Stuff My IT Guy Says are going to go straight onto our YouTube page, just because we love you. Also, follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. There you'll be able to find out what we're going to be doing each and every single episode, comment on old episodes, or ask us for topics in the future. In the meantime, you'll also be able to find out what goes on in the life of the Digital Jesuit. Finally, I want to thank CyberDog in the chat room for doing our show notes and for everyone here at the Brick House who makes This Week in Enterprise Tech possible. Jammer B on our TD board. I'm not sure if he's a camera, but he hates being on camera. But you know what? One of these days, I'm going to get him. Karsten, my super producer, and everyone who makes this show possible. And to you, I say, I'm Father Robert. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep twiet.